Hey, everybody, and welcome to Story Junkies, where we talk books, movies, and television because we're addicted to story. I'm your host, author Pete Bauer.
And I'm Baby Falcon.
My co-host.
Yep.
The character guru.
Well, we'll see.
And I'm the plot guy. And today we're going to take you on a time travel adventure with a film that asks bigger questions than if time travel is even possible.
Dun, dun, dun.
We need like a keyboard. You know what I mean? To actually do that old school.
What? You don't like my singing?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It just makes me think we need a keyboard. Now, time travel is a tricky topic because of the potential of paradoxical situations, such as in The Terminator, where Reese is sent back in time by John Connor to save Sarah Connor, John's mother, before John was born, only to find out that Reese is the father of John Connor. So if he doesn't go back in time, John Connor doesn't exist. But if he doesn't exist, then who sends Reese back in time? Mm. Right? Those are the problems and the challenges with time travel stories.
Now, if you were watching Doctor Who, they pulled a really good fast one by just saying the paradoxes resolve themselves by and large. That's all they had to do.
Yeah, that's really great. That's just brilliant because it just simplifies it all. Because there's many theories about whether if you can change time, if by making a difference in the past that it would create a new timeline or just alter the existing timeline. There's some theories that if we have parallel universes, every time we make a decision, a different parallel universe is created. So that you can, that would be a lot of universes.
That would be, just think about the number of decisions you make a day. Will I have eggs or ham for breakfast?
Well, think about this. That was not in my notes. So I decided to add that. And here's the deal. There's another universe where I didn't even bring it up.
And there's a different podcast. Maybe we can stream it.
You know, let's tap into that one. It would save us a lot of work.
It would. It would save us some time.
Yeah, if we could just have the other versions of us do our work for us. Mm-hmm. This is awesome.
But then we wouldn't be making decisions sparking parallel universes. So would those people even exist?
See, this is the problem with time travel and time shifts and time maps.
Don't worry. They resolve themselves by and large.
By and large. There's also the practical issue with time travel, which I think is very funny. I actually saw it on a cartoon. And the problem is that we're on a moving planet that spins. So if we go back in time at any point, we're assuming that the planet is in the exact same part of the orbit, in the exact same spin of its rotation, so that when we went back in time, we'd land on the exact same place where we were.
When in reality, you'd just be in space.
You'd be in space, unless you were really timed it perfectly, right? You could only go back in time, I don't know, maybe 3 years, 22 hours, 10 minutes, 8 seconds. Or else you're going to end up like 3 feet to the left of where you started or in space if you miss it by a day.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I think that's a perfect segue into talking about today's film, which is...
Deja Vu.
Dun, dun, dun!
Another one?
Yeah, I thought I'd mix it up.
We really, really need a keyboard.
I'll see if there's room in the budget.
Wait, I checked. Nope.
Okay. Stuck with me.
But time travel is a fascinating story genre, and the story we're going to focus on today does a great job of exploring these types of conundrum. Now, Deja Vu stars Denzel Washington, Jim Caviezel, and Paula Patton. And the film was directed by Tony Scott, and he's a very visual, fast-moving, fast-cutting director. I think he also, like Michael Bay, comes from music television background or marketing, advertising, TV background, I believe. And the film also stars Val Kilmer, Bruce Davidson, who always plays he's like the president in National Treasure. Captain Pike in Star Trek. You know, his is like...
He's very authoritative.
Yeah, like nice way. Like you want him to be the president because he just seems like a cool guy. He was also the president, Kennedy, in 13 Days.
Yeah.
And also Adam Goldberg. He was on Friends as Chandler's psycho roommate.
I love that actor.
Yeah.
Wasn't he also in Saving Private Ryan?
Yeah. Yeah, he's really good.
He just cracks me up. He's honestly one of my favorite actors. I love watching him on screen.
And he adds a lot of wonderful deadpan sarcasm to this. And he's in a position of authority when it comes to this technology. So it's very funny. And adding a certain level of comic relief in a situation that could otherwise be kind of dry. So time travel stories are tricky because they're usually all about the details and how one small change in some cases can alter everything, like we talked about.
Isn't that the basis of the butterfly effect?
Yes. Yeah, which is a sci-fi story written about someone, they create time travel and they go back in time, and there's a path, and they're in dinosaur times, right? So there's this path that was created where if you stay on the path, you won't alter time, but someone goes off the path and they accidentally step on a butterfly. And so when they come back from their time travel, it's an authoritarian sort of world without any beauty or love, because what that butterfly inspired over time was lost.
Oh.
Yeah. I forget what that was called.
I think it's called The Butterfly Effect.
No, there's movies, at least one of them, called The Butterfly Effect with Ashton Kutcher that kind of tackles the same thing. But I think the origins of that concept, of that naming, was from that short story.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, as I said, sometimes it's all about these little details that can alter everything. And sometimes it's about you'd make a change and it doesn't make any difference at all, because you could offshoot a different timeline that you're no longer living on, so you didn't impact yourself before. Or, as Doctor Who says, they eventually work themselves out.
Now, to be fair, Doctor Who never actually explains how they work themselves out. They just say they work themselves out.
Yeah, it's a great writing trick, right?
It's fantastic.
So of all the time travel stories out there, we picked Deja Vu because it asks these questions over the course of an intriguing police investigation, and it includes one of the most inventive car chases in film history, in my opinion.
I completely agree.
So it takes place in New Orleans, Louisiana, a year after Hurricane Katrina devastated the lower parts, including the Ninth Ward. So this is 2006. Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005. The film was actually in pre-production when Katrina hit. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. And they almost canceled the whole film because they didn't think it was going to be possible to shoot there. So after 3 months, they realized, you know what, not only can we shoot there, but we can actually help revitalize the economy by using as many local resources as possible.
Which is such a testament to the city of New Orleans. I visited New Orleans a little bit after Katrina as well. I don't remember what year exactly it was, but the thing that stuck out to me the most, as much as the jazz and the food was great, was seeing the entire community rebuilding their city.
Yeah.
And everywhere you looked, there were people working on projects, and that just was very moving to me.
You know, on a funny note, before we start talking about the movie, Tony Scott had 3 t-shirts made for some of the actors. One was a shirt that said Malcolm X, one said Jesus Christ, and one said Jim Morrison. That's because Denzel Washington had played Malcolm X in the movie Malcolm X. Jim Caviezel was obviously Jesus Christ in The Passion of the Christ. And Val Kilmer played Jim Morrison of The Doors in the movie The Doors.
Yeah, that was an interesting combination of characters. And I was confused as to why until you explained.
So the movie starts with the opening credits, surprisingly.
Really?
Yeah. Like who thought of that? Like, when did opening credits become the opening? When did that standard start?
Man, I don't know. I think we should do a whole episode on it.
Like an entire...
The history of opening credits.
An in-depth
analysis.
Research.
Actually,
heavy.
To be footnotes, honest.
Footnotes everywhere.
You could do that because opening credits have changed over time.
No, they have. They have.
That I don't think our listeners would enjoy that.
I don't think I would enjoy it. But anyway, so in the opening credits, this movie's produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. And his opening credit sequence is as if you're in a car flying down an interstate or a highway in the middle of like a desert. And then there's this big tree on the right-hand side, and then it gets struck by lightning. And then that flashes into the logo for his production company, which is this big tree. I always like when movies that have a little specific take on what they're doing switch those up a little bit. So in this opening, we're flying down the highway at like 1,000 miles an hour, and then we stop, and then we go backwards, and then we go forward again.
And for those of you who haven't seen Deja Vu before, the first time you watch the film, it doesn't become apparent that there's a time travel component to it until about halfway through. So the fact that they put that Easter egg at the beginning, I think, is just a really nice treat for people who've watched the movie more than once.
Yeah, and some other movies have done that, like the first X-Men movie was created by 20th Century Fox. And so when the 20th Century Fox logo ended with their drums and everything in the spotlights, as it fades out, the X remains on the screen like a second longer. In Superman Returns, they went straight from the Warner Brothers theme right into the Superman theme at the end of the logo.
I remember that. That was great.
Yeah. So it's really cool when they just take those a little extra effort to give a wink to the movie you're about to see. So, like, as we always do, we're going to break this down into our 4 acts and talk about each act as we go through.
Let's do it.
All right. So remember, in this story, it's all about the details, especially in the first act, because then those details will become more important later. So in Act 1, the film opens on Fat Tuesday. Crowds of family and friends, along with some of their cars, as well as hundreds of off-duty sailors from the Navy vessels in the nearby Mississippi River, fill up a ferry headed towards New Orleans. The inciting incident of the movie begins when a radio starts playing in one of the cars on the ferry, and one of its workers goes to investigate. He finds a red truck, a Ford Bronco, with no license plates. He looks in the back of the truck and finds it is packed with homemade explosives. At 10:50 a.m. on Fat Tuesday, the Bronco explodes, setting off a chain reaction, causing the ferry to blow up, killing nearly everyone on board the ferry. And Tony Scott, as we mentioned, is a very visual director with a lot of quick shots. And what I like about what he does at this moment is using a moving camera and all these really fast takes, he does a wonderful job of showing us all the important locations that will become in play later while these people are going on the boat. So he'll show this bridge, he'll show the car, he'll show everything. And it's so quick, you don't even know that as a viewer, you're getting all the information you need to understand it later. Doug Carlin, played by Denzel Washington, is an ATF investigator from the Department of Justice, and he arrives at the scene. Mayhem is in play. People are looking for their missed loved ones. Some survivors are injured. There's quick shots of paramedics helping out. We see dead bodies, some on the dock, some in body bags. Police and investigators from every agency are on site, searching everywhere, on the shore and in the water. A phone rings inside a body bag. A police officer looks at the bag, realizing someone is looking for their missing loved one. That's really sad.
It was really fascinating to me how that moment in particular touches you so deeply, because you've just seen the dock crowded full of people looking for their loved ones. And yet it's that cell phone ringing that really pulls at your heartstrings.
Yeah. And of course, at a time like this, this is 5 years after 9/11, where we spent hours on television watching people trying to find their loved ones and posting pictures of lost loved ones. It's very reminiscent of that. When this movie came out, I'm sure that was even more powerful, because that was far more in the consciousness of the viewer.
Especially in New Orleans, because it was right after Katrina.
Right. Like one heartbreak on top of another.
And I love that this movie starts on Fat Tuesday, because that's such a unique part of New Orleans culture. It's such an important part of New Orleans culture, and they really embrace that in the film.
Yeah, it's a massive celebration that turns into tragedy, which is also, from a writing perspective, a good choice, you know? Now back to the story. Carlin searches the shoreline and finds remnants of the bomb. He then climbs under the underside of a nearby bridge, a really tall bridge, and he finds residue from the bombs. There's an agent played by Val Kilmer, and his name is spelled in the script P-R-Y-Z-W-A-R-R-A. So I think it's Prizwara. I don't know why you would choose to write that as a script writer. You know what I mean?
That's clearly someone the screenwriter knew.
It could have been Jones, right? But it's Prizwara. So bear with me as I try to say that name. Okay, so agent...
You can just call him Val.
I'm trying to stay with the characters. Agent Prizwara, played by Val Kilmer, arrives looking for Carlin's partner, Larry Minuti, who's not answering his phone. Carlin tells him Minuti is on vacation and introduces himself to Prizwara.
You said that differently.
It's going to be so hard. All right, Val.
It's going to be a long movie.
I'm just going to say Val. We're just going to go with Val. All right, so Val Kilmer. So Carlin introduces himself to Val Kilmer. Carlin then heads back to his office. He watches traffic cam footage from the bridge, and while doing so, a coworker tells him a girl called while he was out and left a message for him. As Carlin calls the girl back to leave a message, another coworker tells him that the Orleans sheriff has found another body. As Carlin leaves his message on the woman's answering machine, he spots the bomber on the bridge of the traffic cam footage from earlier this morning. And again, this is a moment where Tony Scott does a wonderful thing, and the writers themselves, because the timing of this information is awesome. Because what we don't know at the time is that in that moment, Carlin has both spotted the killer and was leaving a message on the voicemail of the woman whose body was just found by the Orleans sheriff. So these overlapping pieces of information, which just seem part of the chaos of the moment, are actually the centerpiece of the entire story.
It's also an interesting moment because as we're introduced to Carlin's character, one of the first things we see is his skill and competence as an investigator demonstrated. We see him looking around and there's a lot to unpack. There's a lot of bodies. There's a lot of evidence. Then this new body is about to turn up. He's got this random voicemail. His partner is out of town. There is a lot that he has to think about. And what we see by Denzel Washington's character is that he knows where to look. So as he's unpacking this whole scene, what he notices is in the bridge is that if a certain type of accelerant was used, the only place they would find evidence of it is on the bridge because there wouldn't be any evidence in the water. When he singles in on the bridge, he goes to test his hypothesis and he goes to look for the residue, but he knew where to look. There's so much to unpack and he knew where to look right away.
Yeah, in all of this chaos, which visually in the film is everywhere. It's quick shots of thousands of people doing hundreds of jobs. And the fact that he is able to pick out a single piece of plastic on the shoreline and identify that as a potential piece of the bomb and then notice the residue under the bridge just shows his skill, right? And from a character perspective, as you're mentioning, you want to show the main character to have extreme competence because it makes you want to identify them and root for them throughout the story.
And it's done in a very subtle way so that you buy the role that Carlin plays in the film later on, but it's not super obvious at the beginning.
Right. We find out that there are 543 casualties in the ferry boat explosion. And Agent McCree, played by Bruce Davidson, is heading the multi-agency investigation. Carlin calls the Orleans sheriff, who tells him he found a burned body on the shore near the bridge. Carlin tells him it must have been from the explosion. But the sheriff informs them the body was found prior to the ferry exploding.
Interesting.
The body is sent to the morgue, and Carlin is there while the autopsy is beginning. The dead woman is partially burned, but still beautiful. Her eyes have remained open, and the medical examiner turns her head, and she ends up looking directly at Carlin. You can see in this moment there is some sort of connection between them.
I think it'd also be pretty disturbing to have a dead person's head turned towards
you. No, that's true. Would look, but I mean, the way it's so hard to explain verbally, but Denzel Washington's reaction is he's kind of taken with this poor soul.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Carlin notices that one of her earrings is missing and that she was bound around the hands and mouth with duct tape. The woman is identified as Claire Kuchever, 30 years old. Again, Kuchever. Could have been any name.
That's a good one, though. I like that name.
Kuchever.
Yeah, I think that's a realistic name.
Okay. It's not Prizwara, but, you know. Carlin goes to talk to Claire's father, who arrived in town that day. He finds out she recently broke up with her fiancé, who moved back to Montreal. However, Claire was going to meet someone else the night before, but the father didn't know who. The father gives Carlin Claire's house keys so he can investigate further and tells him that his daughter needs to matter to him more than the rest of those killed that day. And this is a wonderful, subtle piece of foreshadowing. Carlin goes to Claire's house to look around and finds the phrase, "You can save her," spelled out with magnetic letters on the refrigerator. He also sees an ad for a 94 Ford Bronco for sale on the fridge. He goes into her bedroom, where he finds a revolver on her dresser, and he examines the clothes in her closet. He then moves into the bathroom, where he finds bloody footprints on the floor and bloody cloths in the sink. Also, bloody gauze is found in the bathroom trash can. He sees that she has messages on her voicemail and listens to them. One is from her father, about picking him up at the airport. The second is from Claire's friend Beth, who is worried about her. While the message is being recorded, Claire picks up the phone and says someone is in the house with her and she can't talk. The third message is a follow-up call from her dad, who is still at the airport waiting for her. And the last message is from Carlin himself, returning her call. He realizes that Claire was the woman who had called him that day. Back at the multi-agency headquarters, Carlin introduces himself to McCray, and he tells them about Claire's body, that she died 2 hours before the explosion. The residue on Claire's body means she came in direct contact with the bomber, and that if you solve her case, you solve the bomber's case. He tells him that she had recently sold her truck and that the victim called the local ATF the morning of the explosion. After the briefing, on his way out, Carlin spots Minuti's car in the evidence area. They tell him it was brought from the ferry parking lot, meaning Minuti was probably killed on the ferry. McCrae asked Agent Val about Carlin, and they discuss how he had previously worked on the Oklahoma City bombing. And again, like to your point, showing his expertise. They agree to ask him to join the team. Val tells Carlin that he's in charge of a special investigation unit. This is their first case, and they want him on the team. He can find out who killed the girl and his partner. And the end of Act One is where Carlin joins the team.
It's a really great moment when Val asks Agent Carlin.
Oh, come on. You say it. You say it. Come on.
Agent Prizwara.
Dang it. Let's go with Val.
Where Val asks Agent Carlin to join the team because he says something specific. He says, I need someone who can look at a crime scene exactly one time. And what we've seen demonstrated by Carlin in this first act is that that is exactly what he can do. Both at the bridge and in the morgue, when he's looking at Claire's body, he notices there's something sticky on her mouth, and that's what leads him to think that she had been duct taped.
One of the challenges from a character perspective in a movie that's as fast-paced as this is to quickly establish character. That's where casting comes into play. So Bruce Davidson has an authoritative nature, as you said, so it makes sense to put him in charge because you immediately buy it, right? Val Kilmer has like an intelligence, but an everyman intelligence to him. So he's approachable and it makes sense that they would cast him in that. So, I mean, I've written an action movie before and you really have like 75% action, 25% character. You have so little time on the page to actually identify, define, create backstory and believability of these characters in an action movie, especially something directed by Tony Scott, which is the camera is moving, quick cuts, everything like that.
That is so true. Casting is so incredibly important in films like this because in an action film, the point of the film is the action. That's why people go to it. That's what they want to see. But you have to have enough character to give the action meaning.
Right. And what's even interesting to me was when they're showing all the families going on to the ferry in the beginning, there's a little girl who loses a doll. That's actually Elle Fanning.
I noticed that.
From like Super 8 and Dakota Fanning's sister. And I was like, oh my gosh, because she looked familiar, right? But she's such a young kid in this. I mean, she's really, really young. And so I looked it up. I'm like, oh my gosh, she is. She was acting like when she was like, what, 4 or 5 years old? Whatever.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I was acting when I was 4 and 5 years old, but just for myself in my bedroom. So it's not quite the same.
Solo performances for no audience.
Yes.
All right. Okay, so let's move on quickly to Act Two. This is where things will get faster as far as plot goes, so it won't be as plot heavy going forward. Carlin is taken to an impressive facility, inside of which is a bunch of computer screens and servers and monitors, the works. Dr. Alexander Denny, played by Adam Goldberg, runs the tech facility, and they begin looking at footage from the ferry 4 days in the past. The footage moves in and around the boat, down and around as if it were shot on a drone. Carlin asks, how are they able to get such unique footage? And they tell him it's a computer simulation that was compiled from all the available data, including video and audio feeds. They ask Carlin, who knows the town better than they do, because he lives there, to look for anything that appears out of the ordinary. They explain that they can look at the target at a constant state of 4 days and 6 hours ago. They can't fast forward or reverse the footage. It's like watching the past in real time. He asks them, why don't they just wait for the day the bomb goes off, watch who did it, and then go get him? They tell him that they wouldn't have that information until 4 days later, and between now and then, that person could be gone. Or that person could have planted the bombs days earlier, so they need his expertise as an ATF agent and his familiarity with the town to help them know where to look to gather the clues. He tells them to go look at Claire's house. Fortunately, it's in range of the simulation. They go to her house 4 days and 6 hours earlier. They look outside her house. Then they go inside her house. They watch her listen to the voicemail of her fiancé. And while listening, Claire appears to be looking at the camera, their viewpoint, and smiles, again, as if she were looking right at Carlin. Which is interesting because she's dead here, too.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at him again from the past.
Except she's alive this time. Before she was really dead.
Yes.
And now she's alive, dead.
Theoretically dead.
She's both.
Which is a tough thing to pull off. You can tell from his reaction that Carlin is starting to fall for her.
To be fair to Carlin, she's remarkably beautiful.
Yeah, it's not hard. That's not a big leap, you know?
It's not a big leap.
While watching Claire brush her teeth in the sink, Carlin gets a phone call from a crime scene tech at Claire's house in the present time and tells them what they found. the items that Carlin saw before, bloody towels, bandages, etc. The crime scene tech also tells him that Carlin's fingerprints are everywhere, which surprises him because he was careful when he was at her house. Carlin says that the bomber could have cased the ferry days or months in advance, but if they stay focused on Claire, whom they know came in contact with the bomber, they'll notice any small change in her life. The techs agree and they keep watching. And this is a really smart idea from a story perspective. When you have a massive event, if you can take that massive event, which could have 1,000 witnesses and a billion suspects, if you can say, well, I do know that this single crime is attached to that very large crime, is a great way to focus a chaotic situation into a single moment and a single crime. So, while Claire takes a shower, they look around her house, but she comes out quickly in a towel, sensing she's being watched. Carlin asks if she knows they're watching her. They say no, it's only one way. It's in the past. They continue to watch her. She writes in her journal about feeling as if she were being watched. And then we spend more time with her, getting to know her. We watch her sleep. She prays at breakfast. She watches the news, talks to her pet birds. They get to know her, and Carlin feels uncomfortable peering into her life, yet finds himself drawn to her. Carlin leaves the facility to go to Claire's funeral, looking for her ex or anyone else that shouldn't be there, but nobody out of the ordinary shows up. Still, Carlin feels like the bomber was there, watching them from out of sight. Back at the tech facility, Carlin and the team follow Claire on a date. She gets a call from the bomber who wants to buy her Bronco. She tells him her address, but they can't agree on a time for the bomber to come get the truck when no one else would be around, so he decides not to buy it. They can't look at where the phone call was coming from because the caller was outside of their range. That's when Carlin finds out about a headset that someone could wear to extend the range. As he prepared to put it on and drive toward the location of the call, the bomber hangs up. So they go old school and look at surveillance footage from a bank across from the phone booth. They spot the bomber on the phone, but they can't see the bomber's face, and he carries with him a unique briefcase. However, using facial recognition software, they find a security camera footage of the bomber at the ferry dock by identifying his briefcase. But the picture there is also blurry, and the timestamp shows that he won't be there for another 7 hours.
And I think it's important to note that Carlin is leading all of these investigation leads. Like, he's not responding to things. It was his idea to use facial recognition on the bag. It was his idea to look to see if they could see the caller ID on her cell phone. It was his idea to do all of this stuff. So you see him continually be a good investigator and really guide the team.
Yeah, it's in this room of really, really smart people. He's the smartest. That's a really good point. So they go back to watching Claire's life, getting to know her, but knowing they can't stop her death. Carlin suspects that the tech is more than they're telling him. So while everyone is busy, he gets a laser pointer, points it at the screen, and it appears on Claire's wall 4 days ago. She notices it, then the tech goes haywire. And that's the midpoint of the film and the end of Act Two.
Because now he knows there's something they're not telling him.
Yeah, this tech is far greater than what they've said.
It's also very revealing for his character that he's interesting because he's a very good investigator, but he's also a little reckless. He wants answers, so he's just going to shine a laser at it and see what happens. Like, no idea what that's going to do, but he's just going for it. We see later on, he is a terrible driver. Like, in this, there's a couple of car chase scenes that are coming up we mentioned earlier, but he just is very reckless, and it's hard to explain if you're not watching the movie. But I remember watching it and going, I'm not sure I'd feel safe in a car that he's driving.
Like,
he's very reckless about achieving his investigative goals.
You know, and one of the challenges that they overcame here, and it, you know, it just occurred to me, this is the same challenge I had in Damien Hill's Trigger, is how do you make the audience fall in love with a character that's dead? So they do a wonderful job of spending the small moments with Claire, where her defenses are down and she's really herself. And you can see that she's a beautiful person. She's a faithful person by herself, not trying to impress anybody. She takes care of her birds. She sings to them. You know, she prays at breakfast. She's just a really good person. And everyone, not just Carlin, is really taken by her. And because she's so wonderful in her private life, the tragedy that they know she's already dead. I mean, Carlin went to her funeral, right? It weighs on them even more because of how extraordinary she is just in her everyday life.
Yeah, I agree. I think that her character makes not only her death, but the death of all the people on the ferry more real to all of the people investigating the crime.
That's a really good point, because in these big crimes, it's very easy to get, I mean, you can't attach yourself to everybody, right? So this does a great job of allowing us to attach ourselves to someone who we know is going to die. The more you know her and the more you get to know her and the more wonderful she becomes, the inevitability of her death is even worse, right? Like, you're impressed by someone you know is going to die. It's even harder to watch.
And it also goes to show how that humanity is such a crucial part of the investigation. Like, they have all of this great technology, but they need Carlin's instinct in order to give it any value or meaning. And like Claire's father says, I need her to matter to you. And because she does, they're getting leads on who the bomber is.
Yeah, yeah. It's really cool. Okay, so let's move on to Act Three, shall we?
Let's do it.
All right. As the system goes haywire, Carlin admits that he was the one who broke the field. And by doing so, the technicians are forced to explain that while working on tech for another reason, they accidentally created a wormhole in time, and they can look back 4 days and 6 hours into the past. It's a passive time machine, a time window. They can look in one place at one time, 4 days and 6 hours in the past, but that's it. On the other side of the time bridge is the actual past, so Carlin asks a philosophical question. As the team watches the video feed of Claire sleeping, he asks, is she alive or is she dead? They remind him that he went to her funeral a few hours ago.
But they didn't exactly answer the question.
That's exactly right. He pushes them and asks again, is she alive or is she dead? They say she's alive.
Well, point of note, when he asks them a second time, he does so by using a chair to break a computer monitor and says, this monitor is now dead. Is she alive or is she dead?
Right, right.
Which just goes back to the whole, he's got a goal. He's going to get there a little bit recklessly, but he's going to do it.
Yeah, this was working. Now it's not. Is she alive or is she dead?
And she is alive, which changes things.
That's right. So Carlin asks if they can watch her 4 days ago and light can pass through time back to her. What else can go back in time? They say nothing living can go back in time because of the electromagnetic pulse necessary to transfer that person. And that would kill everything electrical in that person, their heartbeat, their brain waves, and everything.
It also means they can't send back any technology.
Right, because it would fry when they sent it back. And even sending back a small thing could shut down the power grid of the region. That's how much power it would take. So Carlin asks, can they send something simple, like a piece of paper? He tells the text to send a note to himself 4 days and 6 hours ago, an anonymous tip about the bomber, so they can catch the man at the dock before the ferry blows up. Dr. Denny tells him that you can't change time. Whatever was done has been done. He says it's physically impossible. Carlin asks, what if it's more than physics? Denny asks, you mean something spiritual? He tells Carlin, God's mind is already made up. Nothing you can do will change the past. Carlin says, maybe. Which is so great. He says all his life, he's been trying to catch people after the crime is committed. He finally has a chance to do it before the crime is committed. They agree to try to send the message. A tech named Shanti explains that one theory says that perhaps they can change the path of the timeline if an important enough event is introduced into the past. Denny explains that it could also change nothing, like throwing a pebble into a raging river. But still, they agree to try. They send back a note to Carlin's desk. They watch it appear on the desk in the past, but it's right after Carlin has left the office for the day. Carlin's partner Minuti finds it and goes to investigate the tip.
Now, at this point in the film, what we actually see is that Carlin does not have a good working relationship with his partner.
Yeah, he left because they just had a fight.
They just had a huge fight. And actually, what they had a fight about, I think, is really important for Carlin's character, which is that he just goes and does things. He goes and investigates, and he never brings his partner with him. So Minuti's irritated because they're supposed to be working as a team, and Carlin doesn't do that. And Carlin's kind of a little arrogant, saying, look, if I have a gut hunch and it just happens to work out, that's a good thing. And it's not me insulting your ego or your personality. It's just what happens in the investigation. And Minuti kind of says, bull, you just like doing things on your own. You need to learn how to work with a team. But what this means at this point in the film for character is that Carlin doesn't really play well with others.
Right.
And in this whole film, he's had to.
Right.
He's had to play with this whole team because he doesn't know how this technology works. It also means that Minuti has something to prove, which is why he goes and investigates.
Yeah, he'll show him.
They both kind of have something to prove. And it's interesting because there's a scene in the movie, and I don't remember exactly at what point in the film it occurs, but Agent Val is talking to Carlin, and Carlin's explaining his basic philosophy of life, which is that you lose everything. Everything you love, you lose. He doesn't have anything to fight for. And it gives a little bit more gravitas to him saying, I want to stop something before it happens. He's like, I want to have something to fight for, because he doesn't. He doesn't have a family. He feels like he's going to lose everything. And he even says, no matter what we do, even if we catch the bomber, we still lose Claire.
And your point about the note is really great, because so when they're about to send the note, Carlin says, you better hurry because I'm about to leave the office. I remember this conversation. I'm about to leave. And what's so great about that is, on screen, they have so little time to establish that relationship and the motive for Minuti to go investigate.
Without calling Carlin back.
Exactly, without telling him anything. So he finds a note where? On Carlin's desk. And it's a tip that Carlin hasn't done. So he's like, I'm going to show you. I'm going to do this, what you do to me. And sends him on this path. It's really, really cool. The fact that they were able to establish that relationship and the motive, as you said, in like, what, a minute of dialogue?
Probably less.
Probably less, yeah. The Tex and Carlin, through the machine, follow Minuti to the ferry dock, where he confronts the bomber. The bomber shoots him through the truck door. Now Minuti is still breathing, and the bomber loads him into the back of the truck. Minuti's car is left at the ferry parking lot, just like they found it. And they have to ask the question, have they actually changed anything, or have they started things into motion that have already happened? Looking at the footage, they finally get a picture of the bomber's face. However, he's driving away out of range of their technology. Carlin takes the booster goggles, which extends the time machine's range, and drives a Hummer. This is where the filmmakers reinvented the car chase. Carlin is driving the Hummer with the time goggles on. One eye shows him in the past, the other shows him in the present, and we see both at the same time. Carlin is driving in the day, in heavy traffic, trying to follow the bomber, who was driving 4 days and 6 hours earlier in the middle of the night in a rainstorm with no traffic. Carlin causes a number of accidents. As you mentioned, his driving is not great, especially when you're looking into the past at the same time.
I mean, I get that it's complicated and he wants to save 543 lives, but at the same time, he puts like 17 people in the hospital.
No, I know. That is true. I thought about that when I was watching the movie. I'm like, wow, those people aren't just walking away from that. Anyway, so he eventually ends up driving against traffic to keep pace with the bomber in the past, which again, also a bad driving experience for those around him.
Well, and it's a really interesting thematic moment because they've got this split screen thing going on where he's looking in the past and the present at the same time. And now that he's going against traffic, it's like all of this pressure is raging toward him. It's got all of this oncoming traffic, but what he's chasing is in the past.
Yeah. So at one point in the chase, Carlin catches up with the bomber and stops in front of him. And they're both cars have stopped at different times. You know what I mean? And Carlin is staring into the eyes of the killer 4 days earlier. While on the other side of the frame, we see a semi-truck heading directly towards Carlin. And this is what's so great about this scene is the combination of the clarity and the simplicity of the past as far as traffic goes and Carlin's reality, which is he's either weaving through traffic or going through oncoming traffic. And when he finally is basically looking, staring down the killer, even though the killer doesn't know it, in the same time a semi-truck is coming right at you. But you want to look at Jim Caviezel's face. But then all of a sudden you look over to the left and you see the semi coming. You're like, oh my gosh, you know, it was a very well-directed scene.
It's a well-directed scene. And I think it's a well-performed scene, both by Denzel Washington and Jim Caviezel, because Jim Caviezel's gaze really does capture you in that moment. The way that he's looking at the camera, it really does keep you there. Mm-hmm. And you see Denzel reacting to that while at the same time a semi
is coming. And you know that he's not aware of it because you just became aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the semi hits the Hummer and tosses it into a wall, but it still drives and he leaves. Carlin's going to leave, you know, an accident. He speeds off and follows the bomber to the bayou. He gets off the main road and onto a country dirt road. In the past, the driver reaches a fenced-in gate, opens it, and drives inside. In the present, fearing the bomber may still be on the property, Carlin puts on the time goggles and it has a backpack, so it's not only attached to the truck, he can walk with it. So he puts on the backpack and the time goggles, and so they can see the past while he enters the property during the day. In the past, the bomber's truck pulls up to a building. In the present, the building has been destroyed, as if a bomb had gone off. In the building is a burned-out ambulance.
Because of course there is.
Of course there is. Something devastating had happened on this property between the bomber taking Minuti there to the time Carlin had arrived in present time. Carlin follows the time footage to the docks where, in the present, he sees burnt cement on the ground. In the past, they find out that is where the bomber placed Minuti's body. They watch in horror as the bomber pours gas on Minuti, shoots him in the head, and then lights him on fire. In present time, Carlin follows a blood trail to a dock where caged alligators are kept underneath it. He looks inside and sees Minuti's body, half eaten. Carlin realizes that by sending the note back, they caused Minuti's death. They were the reason he drove to the ferry dock and why his car was found at the evidence lockup. They also realized the gunplay and damage to the bomber's own truck forced him to go get a new truck. Originally, he didn't need her car, but because Minuti went to the dock, he now needs to replace his car because bullet holes in a truck would be suspicious. And having already talked with Claire, they now know that he went back, stole her truck, and kidnapped her. They realize again that they haven't changed anything. As a matter of fact, their time experiment may have been the cause of both Minuti and Claire's death. In the present time, in the bombed-out building, with the ambulance inside, Carlin finds Claire's missing earring, meaning she was there at some point before her death. The texts identify the bomber as Carol Orstadt. O-E-R-S-T-A-D-T. What is up with these writers?
These are real names.
Jones, Smith is a real name. Smith is a real name. It's the most common. That and Patel, I think. They discover that the bomber, as I'll call him, has more than one property. At that other property, they find evidence of bomb-making material, receipts, and they eventually track him down and arrest him. Now, Carlin goes to interrogate the bomber at the prison. They find out that the bomber tried to enlist in the Marines and Navy, but was rejected. He's anti-government, but the bomber says his acts weren't about revenge against the government, but about destiny. He tells Carlin how he kidnapped Claire, duct-taped her, took her to the Bayou property, covered her in gasoline to make her look like a victim of the ferry boat explosion, and killed her. Carlin challenges him, saying he's not a patriot but a murderer. The bomber responds, "Sometimes a little human collateral is the cost of freedom." He tells Carlin he has a destiny and will be remembered. He says that Satan reasons like a man, but God thinks of eternity. A bomb has a destiny, a predetermined fate set by the hand of its creator. Anyone who tries to alter that destiny will be destroyed. Anyone who tries to stop it from happening will cause it to happen. And that's what Carlin didn't understand, he said. "So you better have some divine intervention, buddy," the bomber says. "You're gonna need it."
There's a really interesting subtext of belief in this film. Not only this belief in destiny, but also belief in religion, belief in God. We see at the beginning this spirituality of Claire. You know, she prays before she eats her breakfast. And there's actually a moment where Carlin closes his eyes and prays with her as she's saying her morning prayers. He's joining her in her prayers. And he is a man of belief. And then you meet the bomber and he has twisted beliefs, but he has this belief in destiny. And so, and then even later on, with another major plot point that you'll get to, there's a moment that it happens because one of the doctors admits that he believes in God. And so he's willing to take this leap of faith because he has this belief structure underlying everything that he does. So it was really interesting to me to see that theme of belief kind of crop up in different ways throughout the film. And I think it was most obvious in this conversation between Carlin and the bomber.
And the concept of fate and destiny is really interesting because, again, it's a predetermined outcome, right? And there's nothing you can do to change it. I actually wrote a story about fate called The Box, about a virus that gets out into the open and a little girl finds it and brings it home. And there's this whole series of events which lead to the inevitable conclusion. So I really appreciated that part of this story, because especially adding that to a story about time and whether you can go back and change time. And everything we've seen so far is that you can't.
Yeah, because everything they've done has only led what happened to happen.
It's like what the bomber says, is that anyone who tries to stop the bomb from happening will cause it to happen.
And to be honest, there's only more evidence that's going to be given to that thought as we continue on with the rest of the story.
Yeah, so it's a great idea. And I think they did a really good job as writers of showing that fate is like a raging river that you can't change. Now that they've arrested the bomber, Carlin goes back to the tech team and is told by McCray, the leader of the investigation, that now that they have the bomber, the time machine was going to be shut down and they were going on to its next location. And Carlin asks, what about Claire? He's going to kill her. McCray says, he killed her 4 days ago. In the meantime, while the system is shut down, Dr. Denny watches the video of people mourning the loss of those killed in the bombing. Carlin goes back to Claire's apartment and sees the letter magnet message, you can save her, and a Baptist church flyer that talks about revival. This gives Carlin an idea. He calls Denny at the facility. Denny is alone. Everyone is gone, and he's been expecting Carlin's call. They both know what they have to do. Carlin meets Denny back at the facility. He undresses to keep the mass of his time travel as low as possible. And that's where you were talking about earlier. They have a conversation, do you believe in God? And Denny, as a scientist, especially in today, reluctantly agrees that he does.
Well, the conversation goes something like Carlin asking Dr. Denny, I thought you believed she died 4 days ago, or that this won't work. Like, I thought you believed this won't work. And he's like, yeah, well, I also believe in God. Just don't tell anyone.
Right. And think about that from just a spiritual perspective. If you believe in God and you believe in his creation and you believe that he, for whatever reason, you have access to play in this part of his creation and you don't do something, how do you answer that at the end of your life if you believe, you know? So it's a really good conundrum, because are you supposed to mess with time, right? That's his time. Or did he give you access to this tool so you could go fix time? You know, it's just a really, really neat idea.
Is it about prevention or is it about justice?
Right.
Both of which you could say are objective goods.
So Carlin gets into the little time capsule location. It's hard to explain through words.
It's a metal tube.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was so much easier. And Denny warns him about the electromagnetic pulse that will kill him, and that the most probable outcome is that in 4.5 days, he'll get a call from someone telling them they found a body. And it's him. Carlin nods his head and they continue. Carlin is sent back in time. And that's plot point 2 and the end of Act 3.
Dr. Denny also says, you don't have to do this, you know. But Carlin replies, what if I already did? And that's really the question, to be honest, that's been presented by the whole film. What if he already did?
Yeah. And as things have gone so far, it hadn't made a difference. Also, like if you're Carlin,
why would you do that?
Like, do I do this to fulfill the failure, or is this part of me changing the failure?
Is there still a chance?
Yeah.
A lot of interesting questions are presented, and I really enjoy that about the movie.
Yeah, especially because, look, at its core, Deja Vu is a popcorn movie.
Oh, yeah, it's totally a B-level action flick.
Right, it's not a deep... deep story, right, of resonance that we're going to talk about, all the layers of philosophy and physics, but it tackles it. It throws it in there, you know, in a very entertaining way.
It's kind of like when you're in your high school English class, when your teacher is asking about the symbolic nature of the fact that the main character is wearing a blue suit and you have to write like a whole dissertation on it. And then you become a writer as you get older and you're like, I just like the color blue.
That's right.
Kind of like that.
Yeah.
Imbuing a lot of meaning into things that may have meaning, but also may not.
Or if I may, sometimes as a writer, the fun part for me is coming up with people's names that actually mean something, right? But these guys gave up on that and just came up with names that are really spelled strangely and obviously are friends or relatives.
I think they did it to torture you specifically.
This was part of their time experiment.
Part of their time experiment.
So 14 years into the future,
yeah,
they were going to go, you know, this is going to irritate Pete a little.
A little. And it's totally worth it.
Well, it worked. Okay, so we ready for Act 4?
Let's do it. Let's bring this baby home.
Let's bring it home. All right. Carlin is sent back in time 4 days and 6 hours into the past. Their target location was a hospital surgery room. Carlin's body convulses violently on the gurney. The hospital staff rush to his aid, cut open his shirt, where they find "Revive Me" written in permanent ink on his chest.
That's not weird. As a surgeon.
But that's where he got the revival thing from, the Baptist flyer.
No, I totally understand why he did it. I'm just saying, like, if I were operating on someone and then a random person showed up with "Revive Me" written on their chest, I would go on as if that's completely normal.
Right. I think I would respond by, "Don't tell me my job." And then revive them, just out of spite. So Carlin awakens hours later. It's 8:05 in the morning of Fat Tuesday. The bomb will go off at 10:50 a.m. Carlin steals clothes and an ambulance and heads to the bomber's Bayou property. I wonder how this is going to end up. Claire is bound and gagged in the undamaged building on the property. The bomber douses her with fuel, then beats her. Carlin bursts through the building wall in the ambulance, is shot at by the bomber, who rushes out and turns on the propane tank in the building. The bomber shoots at the tank and the building goes up in flames, but Carlin pulls Claire out before the building explodes. But the bomber has escaped. They take the bomber's original truck with the bullet holes back to Claire's place. He uses towels and gauze pads to clean up his wounds from the explosion. He puts "You can save her" message on the fridge. Skeptical of him, Claire pulls a gun. He didn't ask her any questions. He knew where she lived and knew what was in her closet.
Good for Claire. That is super sketchy behavior.
Right. I know. He just picks her up, drives to her place, knows where she lives, tells her not to wear that dress because that dress is the one she died in. Yeah, a little creepy. She calls the ATF to verify his identity, then asks for Carlin to call her back. This is the message Carlin checked at the beginning of the story. She asks him to explain himself, and he says, "What if you had to tell someone the most important thing in the world and you knew they wouldn't believe you? What would you do?" "I try," she said. "You never know what someone might believe," which goes back to your point about belief. She's distraught, and he takes the gun from her and places it on the table. She finishes bandaging him up, and they continue to bond. She throws the bloody gauze into the trash can. Carlin realizes, once again, he hasn't changed a thing.
And he was also right. He already had traveled back in time.
Yeah, because the first time he goes to her house,
all the bloody gauze is there.
He's already been there.
As well as "You can save her."
Right. The phone rings. Carlin tells her it's her best friend who is worried about her. The phone goes to voicemail, and Beth starts to leave her message, worried that Claire hasn't contacted her. Claire picks up the phone and tells Beth she'll call her back, that someone is with her. This is just like the message Carlin heard days earlier when he went to her place. Carlin explains basically that the government has tech that can see into the future and that he has to defuse the bomb before it goes off. Meanwhile, back at the docks, all the naval officers and families enter the ferry boat, repeating the images we'd seen at the beginning of the movie. And that's an interesting choice because, again, there's an inevitability to it because the shots are exactly the same. We're back in that same moment in time that we started in. Claire and Carlin race back to the ferry dock and she points to her Bronco parked on the ferry. He tells her to wait until he gets on the ferry, then tell the police officers nearby about the bomb. They'll take her into custody, but at least she'll be safe. As the bomber is about to leave the boat, get on his motorcycle, and drive to the nearby bridge to watch, he notices his own truck on the dock, and unlike the first time, the bomber goes back onto the boat. So this is the first time something has changed.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time their actions have actually altered something.
Which is both good and bad.
Right.
Because now he's on his way back, but things are different.
Right. That doesn't mean it's going to be good.
Yeah, that's true.
So Claire notices that the bomber's running back onto the boat and she follows him. Claire follows the bomber to where the cars are parked on the ferry, while Carlin, on the top of the ferry, looks back to the bridge where the bomber should be watching, but he isn't there. The bomber finds Claire near the Bronco and holds a gun on her. Carlin goes down to the cars. He's running out of time. He knows the bomb will go off in 5 minutes. On the car level, a guard finds the bomber, and the bomber shoots him. The sound of gunfire sets off a panic. Other ferry guards, as well as some brave sailors, try to help, but the bomber keeps them at bay. Carlin sneaks into the car lot, where he finds Claire inside, tied to her Bronco's steering wheel. And the back of the truck is loaded with bombs. Carlin confronts the bomber, stating back to him the bomber's own sentences he shared with him in the interrogation room. He tells the bomber, "Satan reasons like a man, but God thinks of eternity," that it's going to take divine intervention to stop him, and that sometime human collateral is the cost of freedom. The bomber, confused, shakes his head and, as if aware of the change of his destiny, says, "It's not supposed to be this way." As the bomber is about to shoot, Claire starts the truck and runs into the bomber, pinning him against another car, and Carlin shoots him dead. Time is running out before the bomb goes off. They can't defuse it in time. Carlin gets in the truck and tells her to hit the gas so they can drive off the ferry and into the water before it blows. She does as he asks, and as the truck sinks, Claire is able to escape, but Carlin is trapped. As she reaches the water, the truck explodes, killing Carlin, but everyone on the ship is saved, at least those not killed by the bomber with the gunfire. Claire is brought to the dock, where she waits to be interviewed. She is met by ATF agent Carlin.
From the past, not the future.
Correct, who has come to investigate. He asks her if they've met. She says yes. She says, "What if you had to tell someone the most important thing in the world, but you knew they'd never believe you?" He said, "I'd try." And that's the end of the movie.
Very enjoyable movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like we said, it's a B-level action movie, but it's fun. It's creative. I think it's got some good character moments. It's a nice way to spend the evening.
Right. I like it. It's a B-movie that is inventive, and most B-movies are not. It's an action movie that is inventive, and most aren't, right? Most of them are just recycled or make things bigger, explosions or faster car chases or use special effects or something like that, where this is just like, we're going to take an ATF investigation of a terrorist act and layer in time and then layer in belief and layer in destiny and layer in fate and layer in, you know, it's just, they don't have to do that, but they took a fun action movie and made it deeper than just a B-level movie. It's interesting, though. The critics didn't really like it. They called it a gimmicky picture. And they also don't, they just think that Tony Scott's directing got in the way. See, I get about, it's like reading a book or watching a movie. The best things is when you aren't aware that you're reading a book or watching a movie. Right?
Very true.
But I like sometimes when directors flex their muscles. I like when Hitchcock purposely sets you up and it's a really long shot and you're like, I know what you're doing and I don't want you to do it. Or I like Michael Bay blowing things up unnecessarily sometimes. And I like Tony Scott. I like when directors do something a little special, or I don't know, they have their own fingerprint, which is a little, I don't know, it's a little visually excessive sometimes, but I enjoy that in certain movies. And I would much rather have Tony Scott direct an action movie than not have him direct an action movie, because he adds urgency and speed and action just by the way he shoots the shots, let alone these sequences that occur in the movie.
I think the real differentiator, because every director does bring their own style, is whether or not you can get used to the style while watching the film.
Right.
Or if it's always jarring. So as an example, I can't remember who directed The Hunger Games, but I remember there was a lot of critique when The Hunger Games first came out because the camera moves a lot and it's kind of shaky at the beginning. And it's very jarring at first, but you do get used to it. And that was an intentional decision to actually hide some of the violence because it's a movie about kids killing kids and he didn't want it to be super gory. So the moving of the camera actually served a larger purpose. So even though the beginning is rough to get through, after a while you do get used to it. And I think if you can do that in a film as a director, then you bypass that critique. But if you're always doing something that jars the audience, that can be kind of hard to get used to.
Well, we have a recent example of that. We just watched Armageddon recently from an early Michael Bay movie. And you could tell he had not found his rhythm as a storyteller. He was a visual filmmaker, but he was not a storyteller. And his camera movement and shots, and he could, as I've said before, Armageddon is a movie that has, it's a bunch of really interesting, cool shots that don't even make a good scene. And together, it doesn't even make a good movie. And that's a perfect example of where his style at that point of his career got in the way of the story. It kept interfering with what you were trying to absorb in the story. It was kind of a mess.
I really struggled in that movie. If we weren't making fun of the movie while we were watching it, I don't know that I could have made it through. It was rough.
Yeah. So with Deja Vu, even though the critics didn't like it, the audiences did. And it made over, I think, almost twice or over twice its budget worldwide.
That's great.
Yeah. But I like the fact that the film asked bigger questions about destiny and faith and God. And I think this is partly influenced because Tony Scott and Denzel Washington had worked a lot together. They did Unstoppable after this. They did The Man on Fire before this, I think. I think it was before this. And Denzel Washington is a very faithful, devout man. And he always, just in his own acting process, has a layer of spirituality, or he always assigns a Bible verse to each of his characters, whether they're good or bad, that it kind of assigns in the spiritual understanding where this person fits. And so I think part of that spiritual side may have been Denzel Washington's influence. I don't really know. But I will say that what's interesting is that this script was the highest paid script at that time. Just to buy the story was $4.5 million.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the writers, his last name's Rosio, I want to say. He's written a lot of movies we've seen. He's a very good writer. But he did not like this movie. He loved his story. He said that Tony Scott's direction actually opened up plot holes that he made sure didn't exist. So he can't even watch this movie because it's not... They went out of their way. He and his co-writer went out of their way to button up the entire time concept. And somehow they didn't like Tony Scott's version of it, which is interesting because I'd love to know what the difference would be.
Yeah, I'm fascinated.
But Tony Scott said, listen, I only had 19 weeks of pre-production because of Hurricane Katrina. So he's like, at some point, you have to start shooting a movie. And it's really sad because Tony Scott eventually ended up killing himself, committed suicide. So that's just horrible.
That's really sad.
But because I really like his movies. He did Enemy of the State with Will Smith. I mean, he's just... I like his movies. They're fun, escapism, and it's just so hard to think that someone with so much talent and so successful, right, at expressing that talent just still wasn't filled in some way, you know? I don't know. So anyway, I found the film clever and surprisingly deep for a popcorn flick and one of the better explorations of the time travel genre.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. It's a fun movie to watch. I'm glad that we talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah, it is a fun, cool movie. And Denzel Washington...
I mean, he's great.
One of the best leading men in film history, right?
He's great.
He has such a great level of gravitas and humanity and depth just in his presence on the screen. I mean, it's a rare thing. He's one of these really good actors that if he's a mean guy, you believe it. But generally, he just has a wholesomeness. Like when he turns that on, he's able to emote like a depth of humanity. He's just really, really good.
He's got a little bit of natural charm, which
yeah.
you can't buy that. Like no, natural charm that just comes.
And he's handsome. Tremendous. Just tremendous. And the other cast is really good too. If you want to escape and have a little depth at the same time and have a lot of fun and see one of the most inventive car chases in film history, check out Deja Vu. It's a good thing.
So that is it for today's episode. We hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a comment below and let us know what you think. And
if you'd like to time travel, you could just go back a few minutes and re-listen.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, that would be in line with Deja Vu.
Podcasts are generally time travels, experiments, because when people listen to it, it's not the time we recorded it. Right?
Technically speaking... Anytime you look at yourself in the mirror, you're looking into the past.
Just from the time the light takes to yeah. 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 Wow. Time is a lot more fluid than I thought.
It's a lot more complicated than you thought.
We'll leave it with that. How about that?
Yeah. Meditate on that.
Yes.
That's what we want to leave you with in today's episode.
That's right. Let's confuse your entire existence. All right. So listen, thank you so much for joining us and we'll see you guys next time.